Even people who are not prone to think in terms of conspiracies can occasionally wonder about the people who call the shots in economic terms around the world, especially after the so-called experts screw up and crash the economy like they did several years ago. Today's guest was one of the so-called experts at one time, though he was out of the business by the time of the crash. John Perkins revised his pre-crash book into the newly released New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John Perkins worked as the chief economist at an international consulting firm that gave advice to corporations, the Federal Treasury Department, the World Bank, and a host of foreign governments. He quit that life and ended up studying indigenous cultures and sustainable living. The original Confessions of an Economic Hitman in 2004 spent more than a year on the New York Times bestseller list. John Perkins, welcome to The Exchange.
It's great to be with you, Jeff. Thank you for having me on your show.
We're glad to have you. So hitmen kill people. What do economic hitmen do or kill?
Well, really, more than anything, we put people in debt. And so we've really created the world's first truly global empire. And it's a corporate empire, not really an American empire. And I think perhaps the most generic way that we do this would be fair to say that we identify countries with resources our corporations want, like oil, arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations, and yet the money doesn't actually go to the country. It goes to our own corporations that make huge profits off building power systems, highways, ports, industrial parks, infrastructure that benefits those corporations primarily, and a few wealthy families in the country who own the industries and the commercial establishments. But the majority of the people suffer because money is diverted from paying for health care, education, other social services to try to pay off the interest on the debt. And in the end, the principal is never paid off. And so we go back at some point and say, hey, you know, since you can't pay your debt, sell your resource, oil, whatever, cheap to our corporations, and privatize. And sell your or give or sell your electric utilities, your water and sewage systems, your banks, your schools, your jails, all your public service businesses to our corporations. And I have to say, Jeff, that in the few instances where the economic hitmen fail, then the jackal hitmen go in. And these are people that either overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. And I talk in the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman about several recent cases of that and cases that I was involved in where we economic hitmen failed and the jackals assassinated leaders or overthrew them.
And in fact, you've made some claims about interconnections between the company for whom you once worked and the National Security Agency. A couple of people have called you on that, but you insist it's true.
Well, there's no question that several of the high executives were in Charles C. Maine, the company where I was a chief economist, that was my official title, they were in the military reserve and they were liaisons with the intelligence community, with the CIA and the NSA. That's a fact.
All right, you mentioned in the preface that you got threats for writing the book in the first place. Can you go into some more detail there?
Well, yeah, after I finally got out of the business, I was in for 10 years. I got out in 1980 and started to write a book about this. And I wanted to be an expose where I included others. So I called other people who had been in the same business, other economic hitmen and some of the jackals. And very soon I got anonymous phone calls threatening my life and that of my infant daughter. And I also got taken out to dinner about the same time by the CEO or the chairman of the board of Stone & Webster, which had been a rival firm of ours. And he said, you know, you've got a great resume. We'd like to use it in our proposals. You don't have to do any work for us. Just let us use your resume. I'm prepared to write your consultant's retainer check for $500,000. Just don't write the book. So my life's being threatened. My daughter's life's being threatened. And I'm being offered a bribe. It's a completely legal bribe, but nonetheless, it's a bribe. And you know, what would you do? I took the money. And in my own self-defense, I'd say I didn't go out and buy a huge mansion or a fancy car or something. I went back to the countries that I'd screwed and tried to help them. I formed nonprofit organizations like Dream Change and the Pachamama Alliance. And you can learn more about them by going on my website, johnperkins.org, or their websites. And I started writing books about indigenous cultures, shape-shifting, the world is as you dream it. That was okay with Stone & Webster as long as I didn't write about my experience in that business. And then on 9/11, I was in the Amazon, but shortly after that, I went to Ground Zero, and I decided that I had to write this book as I looked into that still smoldering pit. But this time I decided it wouldn't be an expose, it would be a personal confession. I'd write it completely in secret, and once it got out into the hands of publishers, I figured it would become my insurance policy, that any good jackal would know that the last thing they would want to do is make me a martyr and bring attention to me and the book, so which would make it sell many, many more copies.
So I'm trying to follow the logic train here, though, just on the economic hitman part of it, before we even get to the jackal. So the country's government goes into debt and becomes beholden to the corporation that loaned it the money in the first place. So I can see the dollar benefits, but, I mean, does there have to be the human misery that comes with that? I mean, could anybody figure out a way to be able to make this lucrative for the corporation without hurting the society?
Well, yes, and that's what I devote the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman to, as a strategy for how we can turn this around. We've been operating under a global economic system that's essentially based on ripping up the very resources upon which it depends. It's based on debt and fear and in essence, the ravaging and destruction of our resource base. Ultimately, it's not going to work for anybody. And the resource base, to a large degree, has come from the developing countries, the ones who've taken these loans. And when they take the loans and they open themselves for our corporations to demand that they can go in and take their resources without any real environmental regulations or social regulations. And we need to move, and I call that a death economy. It's in essence an economy that's consuming itself into extinction ultimately. And we need to create a new economic vision, a new economic model, if you will, that what I call a life economy.
All right, we'll come back and talk about the life economy and what John Perkins calls the death economy and the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And the cover of the book shows bleeding continents all around the world. We'll come back and talk more with John Perkins about his book, and you can call in and send emails as well to join the conversation. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John Perkins, who worked for a major consulting firm that gave advice to corporations and countries and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. He wrote a book in 2004 called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and he's revised it now, post-crash, into the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman, with a whole set of chapters that deal with things that happened from 2008 on. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, John, it seems like this process by which corporations go in and make loans to countries, agree to build the infrastructure and get access to the natural resources, which leave the company richer but the country poorer, it seems like at some point some country would say, you know, we saw you do this someplace else. We don't want any part of this. Why does that not happen, or does it?
Yeah, well, it's happened a few times. I talk in the book about how two of my clients, democratically elected president of Ecuador, Jaime Roldós, and the head of state of Panama, Omar Torrijos, did exactly that. They said, we don't want anything to do with this. And I spent a lot of time trying to convince them otherwise, because that was my job. I also had great respect for their integrity and fear for their lives, quite frankly. And you got to figure that all of these presidents and other high officials know what happened to Salvador Allende of Chile and Arbenz of Guatemala, Mossadegh of Iran, Diem of Vietnam, Lumumba of the Congo, and so many others who, when they stood up to the system, when they refused to cut these deals, they go down. They're taken out in coups and often assassinated. Both Roldós and Torrijos, my clients, were assassinated because they didn't play the game by CIA assets. And most recently, in 2009, President Zelaya of Honduras was taken out in the same way. And, of course, we know the tragedies that have happened recently. Two amazing environmental activists have just been assassinated in Honduras. And that's happened since the coup that overthrew Zelaya. He was overthrown because he wanted to implement policies that would raise minimum wages substantially and had a huge impact on Dole and Chiquita and other big global corporations.
So when you were training to do this work for the now defunct Charles T. Maine Company, what were your personal reactions? I mean, what were the kinds of things you were being told about what you were doing and why you were doing it?
Well, as I describe in the book, I was trained by this woman named Claudine Martin, and she knew exactly what she was doing. I had gone through a testing process previously with the National Security Agency, a couple of days of personality tests, including quite a lot of time on a lie detector. And Claudine knew a lot about my personality. She knew that I'd grown up poor and a New Hampshire teacher in a boys' prep school surrounded by very wealthy kids. I had a great desire to travel the world, fly first class. I think I was attracted by perhaps the three big drugs of our culture, power, money, and sex, and she knew all this. And she let me know that I would have all that if I played this game. And in addition, the system that she described was what I had been taught in business school was the right way to go. In other words, we were taught, and this is still taught in business school, that if you want to help a poor country become wealthier, you invest a lot of money in these infrastructure projects. And the fact that they make our corporations wealthy is just kind of a consequence of all that. But that's what you're taught. And in fact, the statistics show that that's true, that the economy does grow. And so when I first got into the business, Jeff, I thought I was doing the right thing. It met all the criteria of my education. But then over time, I saw that the statistics were terribly skewed to the very rich. You know, recently it just came out that 62 individuals have as much wealth as half the world's population. And in all these countries, and including increasingly in the United States, our economic statistics revolve around the very wealthy, the bankers, the financial people, the people that own industry. And so what I began to see was even though the statistics showed economic growth, the poor were getting poorer. And they were the vast majority of the people, while the rich were getting richer. So as I get deeper and deeper into the system, I saw that it was a subterfuge, that it was really a lie. It was not helping the poor. It wasn't really helping the countries. It was helping a few wealthy families in those countries.
John Perkins was once the chief economist for a company doing a lot of work in other parts of the world, advising businesses and countries even. His book is The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, a revision of his 2004 book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Here is Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hiya. Jeffrey, thank you so much for your programs, this one especially, and John, thank you. I'm wondering if you could possibly reflect on the current election campaign in the United States, Snakes, and especially if you could focus on Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders. Wondering if you were maybe one of their advisors, or if you were the president, what might you recommend in terms of both domestic and foreign policies, especially focusing on economics? Thank you again.
All right. Thanks for that, Skeeter. Appreciate it. Yeah, I would say some of the stuff in here does resemble the thinking of Bernie Sanders as he expresses it. So what do you say, John?
Well, Skeeter and Jeff and everyone, I'm on a pretty constant speaking tour right now, and one of the things I keep telling people is it does matter who the next president is, especially symbolically, but we all need to recognize that the president has very limited powers these days. And the big corporations call the shots in Washington. So even if a guy like Sanders should get into the White House and not accept a penny from corporations, he's going to be surrounded by senators and representatives and lobbyists who receive a tremendous amount of money from corporations and who know that if they lose their elections or decide not to run, they'll get extremely lucrative consulting jobs with corporations. So the president has very limited powers, and we've certainly seen that with Obama. So I think the good news is we have seen that strongly, and we know that we, the people, have to do it. So, Skeeter, I encourage you to think a little bit less about what policies you'd recommend to Sanders or whoever, and think more about what you can do to actually make those things happen. So choose whatever it is that attracts you to a candidate and make a commitment that no matter who gets in the White House, you're going to push. You're going to use social media, which makes it much easier these days. Every day you're going to take some action to help further that cause, that issue, because ultimately we, the people, have to do it. Our leaders are not in a position to do it. They're surrounded by so much money and what's really become legal corruption. This campaign financing laws are just outrageous. We need to change those. But in the meantime, we need to recognize that our leaders, our president, just has very, very limited powers. We used to think the president could select the next Supreme Court justice, and even that's been called into question now.
Yeah, well, that's a good point right there. Let's take another call from George in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Perkins.
Wow, this is the kind of program we need over and over again to offset corporate media, because without you guys, we wouldn't hear anything like this. Please, can you define what's going on with Sanger, I believe his name is, and what he's doing to a South American country, and what it is that we could keep that from happening? Thank you so much.
All right, thanks for that, George. Appreciate it. Do you know which country he's talking about, John?
I believe he's referring to the Vulture Funds, Paul Sanger. Yes, is that correct?
I believe that's the case. Let's see what I can find out. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So, well, this is a great case of a great example of how the economic hitmen today have just expanded their operations and have taken new guises. So the Vulture Capital funds have just gone in as vultures. And what's happened, I think the case he's talking about is Argentina. Argentina had a great deal of debt, and a lot of it was forgiven by organizations like the World Bank. They understood that the only way for Argentina to move forward was to just forgive the debt. So like what you do when a corporation goes into bankruptcy and you try to help it pull out. These vulture capital funds, these bought up that debt for pennies on the dollar. And then they went after these countries. When Cristina Kirchner was president of Argentina, she was very progressive and very bold, and she refused to negotiate. A new president was just elected a couple of months ago, and he's very right-wing. He negotiated with the Vulture Funds, and they've recently settled at between $4 and $5 billion that Argentina is going to pay. Paul Sanger and his fund actually have made between 10 and 15 times what their original investment was. This is a real economic hit. They went in and they threatened, they cajoled, they used every possible technique they could think of, all the things that we economic hitmen had used against Argentina. And this is going on in many other countries. It's happening in Greece. It's happening in Italy. It's been happening in many South American countries. It's happening in African countries. It's another form of the economic hit that when the real institutions who incurred the debt forgive the debt, somebody else comes in and swoops in like a vulture and takes care of the carrion, so to speak.
So you'd mentioned in the book that this tended to happen in third world countries, but it seems like it's happening more in the first and second world these days as well. Can you give us an example?
One of the reasons I wrote this book is because in the last 12 years, since the original Confessions of an Economic Hitman came out, this system has really metastasized like a cancer. It spread from the developing countries to the United States, Europe, and the rest of the world. The economic hitmen techniques have really come home to haunt us. And, you know, a couple of examples are student debt. Amazing amounts. You know, I speak lots of times at business schools and law schools, and so many of the students there will tell me that they went into these schools because they want to do something good in the world, but then suddenly they realize they've got a couple $100,000 worth of debt, and so they've got to go and work for a big corporation to pay off their debt, and they say, well, but in 5 years I'll get it paid off, and then I can do what I'm meant to do. But what often happens is they fall in love, they get married, they buy a house, they have a kid, they take on more and more and more debt. So this debt thing is enslaving us. We've got something similar with credit card debt, health insurance debt. I mean, this terrible health insurance system that we have, that if someone gets sick, they go deep into debt instead of having some sort of real form of recourse that will help them pay for these things, get deep into debt. It's this constant debt thing that we're going through. And we also have to recognize today, as I referred to earlier, our politicians are so deeply ingrained in this system. I talk about a number of examples in the new confessions, but here's one of them. So Senator Dodd, who was a senator for about 20 years.
From Connecticut.
Very highly from Connecticut, very highly respected, and chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. When he ran for president, and when he ran for president, he took a lot of money from the financial services lobbies and organizations. The very ones that, as chairman of the banking committee, he was supposedly watchdogging. That's extreme corruption on a very high level. And that's just one of many, many examples of how our politicians work these days. So this whole system has come home to the United States to roost. And I could go on and on and on. We don't have enough time, but there's a lot of detail in the book about how the United States has been hit, and so many countries in Europe now have been hit, just within the last 12 years.
Indeed, there is a lot of that detail. John Perkins is our guest. His book is The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning, John. It is all your fault. You're the guy that got me started down this rabbit hole with your first edition of Economic Hitman. And I have to tell the listeners that what this man is saying is absolutely true. Hear him, hear him, hear him. Read his book. It will be a superb primer for opening your eyes on how things really work. Have you read Jane Mayer's books and David Talbot's? That's kind of the path that led me from where you are to where I am today, in terms of Lacey, Mayer, Zinsser, and all of those people. What he's saying, Jeff, is absolutely spot on. Okay. He could not be more correct.
All right. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it. So let's talk about the works of Jane Mayer and David Talbot. Were those inspirations to you or helps to you, John Perkins?
Well, yeah. Thanks, Paul. And Jeff, I think that what's been also been interesting, when Confessions of an Economic Hitman came out in 2004, it was considered to be rather revolutionary. It was probably one of the first books to expose this. There have been a lot of things since then. There's been, the books about John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, and there's just been a slew of books, and then Michael Moore, and then the revelations of Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks. And there's so much that's come out in the last 12 years that I take great heart in this, that people really are waking up. And there really is a consciousness revolution that's going on around the globe. In the last 12 years, I've been on almost a constant globe-trotting speaking tour, including China, former Soviet countries, Middle East, Russia itself, the United States, Latin America, all over. And everywhere I go, I see that people really are waking up to the fact that we live on a very tiny, fragile space station, the Earth, that doesn't have any shuttles. We can't get off. We've got to change it. We've got to move into what they call a life economy, which is an economy that's based on cleaning up pollution and regenerating destroyed environments around the planet, and creating systems that will alleviate the causes of desperation, poverty, violence, and terrorism. We can create a whole new economy, and that's what I think is exciting. So in these past 12 years, a lot of people have exposed the underbelly of this system. And what I wanted to do in this new book was continue with that a little bit, but also present a strategy for change. So this book is all about what you, every one of your listeners, can do to turn this around. There's lists of what retired people can do, and students can do, and businessmen can do, and on of what we can do to really turn this system around, because we must do it. Our politicians aren't going to do it. They can't do it. We have to do it. And that's democracy, if you think about it. That's what it's all about.
All right, let me point out again that the National Security Agency and the State Department raised some issues about the veracity of the claims in the earlier edition of the book, and Becca in Junction City sent an email that left the sentence short. She simply asks, how can we trust anything this man says? What's your response, John?
it's an excellent question. And I think the answer is that the New York Times did a very thorough vetting, and they did an article about the book. It was the whole top of the fold of the front page of the Sunday section of the financial section of the Times, and where they vetted it and went back and looked at college record, looked at my passport, looked at, and they concluded that it was basically all true. So I feel pretty good about that. And my publishers vetted it before they published it. There's been a lot of that going on. And we know all these things happen. We know these presidents were assassinated. I can prove that I was in the, you know, that I worked for these guys. So I'm not concerned about that. I think that evidence has been established very strongly. The NSA, the State Department did publish a website shortly after the book came out. They're called the Misinformation Website, where they said that it obviously wasn't true because I say I was recruited by the National Security Agency, and they said, they quoted the National Security Agency's mission statement, which is that it is just about encoding and decoding messages, that it's a cryptography organization. Well, even back then, everybody knew that wasn't true, that it did a lot more than that. And now with Edward Snowden's disclosures and so forth, it's become very, very obvious that that isn't true. And incidentally, that website sold a lot of books for me.
Oh, did it really? All right. So we're now talking about the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which is an expanded version of the original Confessions of an Economic Hitman from 12 years ago. John Perkins, the author of both and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with him and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John Perkins, who worked for years as a chief economist for a major consulting firm. Took part in what he calls the death economy. He says it's bankers, lobbyists, corporate executives, and others who, in his words, con governments and the public into submitting to policies that make the rich richer and the poor poorer. He writes of this in his revised book. It was once called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. There's a whole new post-2008 section that makes it the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Jacob in Gold Hill. He writes, I read John's original book and have always been deeply impressed. I've recommended the book to just about everyone I know. My question is, how does what he talks about in book one and now the second book apply to the Pacific Partnerships, the TPP? It's hard to imagine that what you're talking about doesn't apply to these trade agreements.
Yes, it very much applies to them. You know, we've seen from past trade agreements like CAFTA and NAFTA that impact Central America, Mexico, Canada, North America, Central America, how much they've devastated things. Something that most people don't seem to understand is that the immigration problem that we have from Central America was caused primarily by NAFTA and CAFTA. As an example, what these trade agreements created was a situation whereby say a corn-growing agribusiness, huge agribusiness in the United States, might cost, as an example, $5 per unit of corn for them to produce a unit of corn, whereas a peasant farmer in Central America might cost him $3 for that same unit. But the agribusiness in the United States gets a $3 subsidy, so they actually it only costs them $2 to produce it. They can take that corn to Central America and sell it for $2.50 and still make a pretty damn good profit and undercut the local peasant who doesn't get a subsidy because his country can't afford to pay subsidies. And the NAFTA and CAFTA agreements did away with tariffs. They call it free trade. So the countries there cannot impose a tariff on that agribusiness to raise the price so it would be competitive with their own growers. They're not allowed to do that. So instead, the local peasants throughout South America, the farmers there, have had to get off their farms, that they can't make a living off of them. And so they swarm to the United States to try to get jobs here. And they live pretty miserable lives here. They send all their money back home. In the meantime, the big agribusinesses have gone down and taken the land that those farmers were on, and they're growing things like broccoli and flowers and stuff that they're shipping back to the United States. And they're also taking advantage of these people that are desperate to make a living and opening up sweatshops and paying them very, very minimal wages. So that's what these trade agreements have done in the Americas, Central America, North America, and Mexico. And TTIP and TPP, the new proposed agreements, will do something on a much larger level. And one of their conditions is that corporations will have sovereignty over countries where they work and will be able to sue governments for lost profits in these countries. There's a lot of detail here, and there's a lot more in the book about this. But the short version is, you know, these trade agreements help no one except big corporations. And ultimately, they hurt the worker in the United States, they hurt the consumer in the United States, and they destroy economies around the world. And they create huge immigration problems.
Let's take another call. Here's John in Veneta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Perkins.
Good morning, guys.
Hi.
I think, a point could actually be made that Bernie Madoff hurt more people by what he did than actually somebody to actually murder somebody, because there was such a trainload of people affected by this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, they every once in a while they take one of their own and throw them in the compost. Basically, the dynamic that's missing is accountability. And when you hear me say that word, oh boy, howdy, do I mean it. You're going to get caught messing around with stuff like this, especially if you're attached to government. I don't care if you're a dog catcher. You're done. Period. We should be doing something more than sitting around wringing our hands. And that brings me to the last thing, which is everybody uses conspiracy theory. If they don't like what this conversation is, they change that. Now, there's plenty of fruitcakes and idiots out there, I know. But there's a lot of lying, cheating, and stealing going on, and we're paying taxes for it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. Thoughts from John Perkins?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. And I think one of the fascinating things right now is that we've had half a dozen or so major global banks that have admitted to creating crimes. They've admitted that their crimes, they paid about $25 billion because of these crimes. But not a single banker has been indicted. Now I ask you, do banks commit crimes? No. People in banks commit crimes. Corporations don't commit crimes. It's individuals within those organizations that commit the crimes. Not a banker has been indicted, and yet the organizations have committed to crimes. And I think this, you know, this point is very well taken, that we really need to look at this. Bernie Madoff has, you know, did destroy a lot of people's lives, but these big banks have destroyed a lot more than that. They've destroyed economies around the globe, including the economy of Greece and Italy and Ireland and so many other places. And these guys are getting away with murder. Not only do they not get indicted, but they pay themselves huge bonuses, because this $25 billion seems like a lot to most of us, but in fact it's a pretty small amount compared to the profits they made over the 20 years or so that they were committing these crimes of rigging the LIBOR rates, the exchange rates, and interest rates on loans. Those were rigged, and they've admitted to it, and yet they haven't been indicted, and that's devastating.
With these deals that you helped engineer when you worked in the business between corporations and countries, we'll build the infrastructure, you're going to pay us, et cetera. Is there any way the corporation can lose? Does the corporation always make money on those deals?
Well, always is a big term, Jeff. I don't know of any instances where the corporation lost. Let me put it that way, and I'm not saying that it hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
But these big companies go in and they make fortunes, and if something goes wrong, you know, if they're building a dam and they discover that there's some flaw in the geography of the area that they missed in doing it, and they have to spend a lot more money than originally anticipated, the banks give them more money, and the country has to pay more, take on more debt. So the banks go in and say, like the World Bank goes in and says to the country, "Hey, they screwed up."
So the point being that the risk is completely socialized.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's go to Andy in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Perkins.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, John. John, thank you so much for the work you've done. Your book and Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine really made an impact on me. I'm wondering, how do you go about talking to conservatives who believe in one world government and explain to them that it already exists through by virtue of these corporations and their sort of shadow government You had mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I don't know if people are aware that Keystone XL is suing us right now, I think, for $15 billion. Could you address both of those questions? Thanks.
Sure. Thanks, Andy.
Well, yeah, it's a big question. That when I talk to conservatives, and I recently have given keynote speeches to a group of almost 4,000 executives of the communications industry in this conference was in Istanbul, and another conference of about 2,000 heads of HR programs, and I often talk at business schools, and I actually find that a lot of corporate executives agree with so much of what I say. They realize that this system isn't working. They realize that when 5% of the world's population lives in the United States and consumes 30% of the world's resources, it's not a model that can be repeated in China or India or Brazil or Russia. It's not a model that's working. It's a failing system. And they don't know how to get out of it. And I asked them, why are you inviting me to speak to a group of CEOs with a book I wrote, conservative CEOs often? And the answer is because they know it's not working. These are smart people. They want to find the solution. And that's where we come in, because so many of these corporate executives tell me, I would like to do a better job. I would like to pay my workers more money in Indonesia or wherever, but I'm afraid that if my costs go up, I'll lose market share, half a percentage of market share, and my major stockholders will get me fired, and I'll be replaced by someone who only cares about market share. So please, they say, please tell the people who read your books, the people who hear you speak, tell them to overwhelm my company with emails demanding that we do something better. Say something like, hey, you know, I love your product, but I'm not going to buy it anymore until you pay your workers a fair wage, or until you clean up the mess of oil pollution that you've caused in the Ecuadorian Amazon, or whatever your cause is. So I would really encourage you, pick a cause, pick a corporation, write an email encouraging them to do a better job, and send that out to everybody on your social networking system, your circles, and ask them to send it out to everybody, and ask everybody to send these emails. Because these executives, are, you know, for the most part, are not bad people. And even if they are sociopaths, they will respond to something that makes them feel that this is the new road to success. Sociopaths are not interested in money. They're interested in being successful. They're interested in proving that they're better than everybody else. So let's give them a new measuring rod. And that is to create a life economy, an economy that's based on serving public interest, on making a better world for ourselves and our children. And I find, as I work with corporations, that so many people in those organizations totally agree with making a better world. They want that. They have kids. They have grandchildren, including executives at high positions. We need to push them. We need to democratize the marketplace and realize that whenever we buy something or choose not to, we're casting a ballot, we're casting a vote. But we also need to organize consumer campaigns to let these corporations know that for them to be successful, they've got to turn the system around.
Vote with the wallet, in other words. Let's take another call from Vince in Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange with John Perkins.
Hi there. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in South America and was quite often asked by the people of the country where I was working if I was a CIA spy, if I was there to investigate how their country worked. And I always said, no, you know, obviously I was working with the blind, you know, and there was nothing that I couldn't see for myself, you know, and I always denied it. But I always wondered, you know, if you ever heard any information about spy agencies putting volunteers in other countries through the Peace Corps, or even just using the information, you know, screening them when they came back and asking them what they saw.
Okay, thanks for that, Vince. Appreciate it. John?
Vince, where were you a volunteer?
Oh, I let him go off the line.
Oh, okay, well, yeah, absolutely. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador for 3 years before I got into the ranks of economic hitmen, and they certainly used my training to do that. While I was being recruited my last year in the Peace Corps, and I write about this in Ecuador, I was asked by the company that ended up hiring me to send back reports on the local economy. And part of that was testing me to see how good I was at it, but they were also getting information. I have no doubt that there's a connection at some level, and I don't know whether it's official or not, but I certainly have known of volunteers who've gone to work for the NSA or the CIA after they got out of the Peace Corps. And honestly, I'm one of them. I didn't actually go to work for those organizations as an employee of those organizations. I was an employee of Charles T. Maine, a consulting firm. But Charles T. Maine had contracts with the U.S. government on many different levels, and I was certainly used to support all of that. So, I encourage people to join the Peace Corps. I think it's really important for Americans, especially young Americans, to travel, to get out, to live in other countries, to learn other languages. As you know, Vince, this is an incredible education process, and we Americans tend to be very isolationist. Europeans often speak several languages. Most Americans don't. And it's important that we understand what's going on in the rest of the world. Going out there and experiencing it is a very good education.
How different is your life now that you're out of that world and are spending time with indigenous populations and trying to make sure you help them in a real way and not through the way you were doing it before?
I am so happy. You know, when I was an economic hitman, I was living this life that I thought I'd wanted to live. Growing up the son of a poor teacher in New Hampshire, I thought I wanted to fly first class around the world, stay in the best hotels, eat in the finest restaurants, wine and dine with presidents and beautiful women around the world. And once I got to doing that, I thought that's what I wanted, but I was consuming huge amounts of Valium and alcohol. I was really unhappy because I understood that what I was doing was wrong. I didn't like it. Now, I don't usually travel first class unless because I fly so much. The airline boosts me up there because they got an empty seat up there. And I don't usually stay in the best hotels. I stay with friends wherever I can go and beg off people. And I love it. You know, this is so much fun. It's so blessed, Jeff, to be on your program, to be talking about these things, to be going out in the world and meeting people. I travel all around. People can go to johnperkins.org to see where I'm going to be. And life is great.
Well, you're having a lot of fun. That's a good thing. The book is called The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, an updated version of John Perkins' 2004 book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John, thanks so much.